of training in terms of the actual remuneration. Medical students are leaving with medical school with £100,000 worth of debt, and they're not looking to pay that off for well over a decade. Whereas if they go to other countries, simply next door, Ireland or Australia, they can immediately double their wage.
The British government seems nowhere near loosening its purse strings. But the consensus is that the longer these strikes grind on, the wider the damage. Saipur is up, London.
The summit of ECOWAS leaders, which ended in Abuja, the Nigerian capital, resolved that closure of air and land borders between ECOWAS countries and Niger is to be lifted in addition to other sanctions.
No-fly zone of all commercial flights to and from Niger is to be lifted. Suspension of all commercial and financial transactions between ECOWAS member states and Niger is to be lifted. Freezing of all service transactions, including utility services, is to be lifted. Freezing of assets of the Republic of Niger in ECOWAS central banks is to be lifted.
However, the ECOWAS meeting called for the ruling authority in Niger to provide an acceptable transition timetable to constitutional order. The ECOWAS leader said the decision to lift the sanctions was based on humanitarian considerations, especially as people are in the month of Lent and the holy month of Ramadan approaches. The meeting asked the three countries that exited the ECOWAS, that are Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali, to reconsider the decisions in view of the benefits the countries and their citizens enjoy in the regional bloc, especially the hundreds of millions of dollars of projects and programs, notably the Food Security Reserve. The ECOWAS leaders therefore urged the three member states that exited the regional body to resort to dialogue, negotiation, and mediation to address their concerns.
The authority has also instructed the president of the commission to invite Burkina Faso, Niger, Mali, and Guinea to attend technical and consultative meetings of ECOWAS, as well as all security-related meetings.
The three West African countries exited the ECOWAS and established what they called the Sahel Alliance after ECOWAS resolved to condemn the military coups in the three countries and to impose sanctions on them. Experts believe that there are solutions in the medium and long terms for solving the crisis in the regional economic body.
The issues I mentioned earlier of pan-Africanism, of resource nationalism, of ensuring that people are carried along in decision-making processes, of ensuring that there is equitable distribution of resources, of ensuring that people have access to the good things of life, of ensuring that the dividends of governance is brought to the people, must be addressed.
As one of the least developed regions in the world, the Sahel faces a multitude of challenges, including poverty, food security, poor governance and insecurity. Experts say some of these challenges are a matter of great concern, not just for the Sahel, but for the whole of Africa and beyond. They also noted that skillful diplomacy must be employed in addressing the exit of the three West African regions from the ECOWAS. Danjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
Iran Zamzam's company is poised to replace two major international soft drink brands in the region, driven by a growing boycott sentiment against Israeli army-associated products following the Gaza conflict. Having already entered markets in Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, and the UAE, the company aims to export 4 million cans of its popular soda to Kuwait, making a significant milestone in its expansion efforts.
My concept revolved around organizing a festival exclusively showcasing Iranian products. However, following the conflict in Gaza and the overwhelming positive feedback we received, We expanded our vision to encompass Turkish and Kuwaiti products as well. The event is spanned 2 months, during which we received numerous requests for an extension. Our primary objective at the Society remains to spotlight Iranian, Kuwaiti and Turkish goods, particularly as consumers are actively seeking alternatives to products associated with Israel.
Zamzam's growth in the Persian Gulf soft drink market is reinforced by its official replacement status for soda drinks in Kuwait alongside local brands like LC and Kenzo. The Iranian-Turkish festival organized by the biggest societies in Kuwait, Al Jabriya, has been instrumental in promoting Zamzam and other locally made alternatives as primary substitutes for boycotted products, significantly boosting Zamzam's popularity and market presence in Kuwait.
We're also operating as a retail seller, catering to the demand for products from Iran, Turkey and Kuwait, which many customers have been requesting. While we understand that implementing boycotts can be challenging to achieve rapidly, it's not unattainable. Therefore, in response to the tragic events in Gaza, we've completely redirected our focus towards promoting locally made products through a campaign titled Support Us to Ice. The response has been phenomenal, with our sales soaring. Moreover, numerous other societies in Kuwait have chosen to follow suit and advocate exclusively for Iranian, Turkish, and locally produced goods.
The shift in consumer preference toward locally produced alternatives like Zamzam is emblematic of the broader economic repercussions of the conflict in Gaza. Major multinational corporations, including Starbucks, McDonald's, and Pepsi Cola, have experienced a significant decline in sales as consumers increasingly opt for products that align with their values and principles. As Zamzam continues to expand its footprint in the GCC countries, particularly in Kuwait, there is a shift in consumer behavior toward more regional products, and particularly the one from Iran, from other GCC countries, which is why the public in Kuwait is shifting into buying more products that are not associated in any way possible with the United States or Britain. This is Farah Al-Hashim, Kuwait City, from Al Jabriya area.
As the Pakistan Super League kicks off for its highly anticipated cricket matches, an unexpected controversy has emerged, leading to widespread calls for a boycott among Pakistani fans.
Oh, that is clear of all fielders.
The uproar stems from KFC's association as a sponsor of the tournament, with critics citing the fast food chain's American roots and linking it to the United States' support for Israel's onslaught on Gaza.
We condemned KFC as a sponsor of our national cricket event. KFC represents a company with ties to Israel. Israel is involved in the killing of thousands of innocent men, women and children in Gaza.
Meanwhile, activists are pushing to boycott the event, urging fellow Pakistanis to refrain from attending matches in person and instead watch the games online from the comfort of their homes. The move not only expresses dissent, but also hits the tournament organizers where it hurts the most, their ticket sales and on-ground merchandise purchases.
I am part of the boycott movement because I believe it's important to stand up for the people of Gaza. By watching online, I am not contributing to the ticket sales or on the on-ground merchandise purchases, which are the main sources of revenue for the organizers. It's a way of hitting them where it hurts.
Usually we would go to the ground, but this year I think a lot of even cricket fanatics have chosen not to just because they want to boycott KFC as their main sponsor. But me personally, I've been skipping a lot of matches as well. We need to show solidarity for Gaza and stick with our brothers and sisters. I think that's more important.
Social media platforms have been flooded with hashtags such as #BoycottPSL and #NoToKFC as disillusioned fans express their discontent over what they perceive as an endorsement of American policies that they vehemently oppose.
The widespread boycott of an international cricket tournament by the passionate cricket-loving nation of Pakistan not only signals solidarity with the people of Gaza, but also serves as a powerful expression of discontent towards the businesses associated with the U.S. and Israel. Nasik Azmi, Islamabad.
In yet another rally to support the Palestinians in Gaza Strip, thousands of Yemenis have filled the streets of the capital Sana'a and other major cities. They chanted slogans supporting Palestinian resistance and condemned the Arab world's indifference toward Israeli atrocities in Gaza.
The Yemeni people were raised since their childhood to love and adore Palestine and to love jihad in Palestine. Therefore, when the opportunity arose to have an influential position under the leadership of Ansarullah, they did not hesitate and went out to the streets, believing that their protests were jihad for the sake of God, as the least duty as long as the borders were not open for them, and they were not able to fight with the Palestinians.
A message to the European peoples. Your governments today are contributing to genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza by submitting to America's orders to militarize the Red Sea. America involves you in its own problems. The solution to stopping the Red Sea operations is to stop the aggression against Gaza and lift the siege. This is the easiest solution. But if your government wants to submit to America's orders, you will see what we will teach. I mean, you will see that we will teach America a lesson that will never forget. And if you attack us, you will unfortunately meet the same fate.
Protesters praised the recent operations by the Yemeni army, including the sinking of a British vessel in the Gulf of Aden. They also celebrated the introduction of the submarine weapon into the Yemeni army's arsenal, believing it will enhance the success of Yemen's naval operations.
The submarines introduced by Abdul Malik al-Houthi are one of the surprises that the enemy is going to face if it continues its aggression against Gaza. The Yemeni armed forces, specifically the Yemeni Navy, still have surprises coming, a wide range of targets, and also a superior ability to obtain information at any time and place. Therefore, these are successive military messages, the content of which is that we will escalate further as long as Israel's war in Gaza continues, and Yemen has the upper hand in its waters, and this position will never change.
Earlier, the spokesman of the Yemeni army announced that they have successfully carried out three military operations. The first operation involved launching multiple ballistic missiles and drones against various targets in Eilat-occupied Palestine. The other two attacks targeted an American destroyer and the British vessel Islander in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden. He added that the British ship was set on fire as a result of the attack.
Every Friday, people gather here affirming that they will never tire of taking to the streets to show support for the oppressed people of Palestine as long as the Israeli genocidal war on Gaza continues. They believe it is the least that all Muslims around the world should do as a religious duty toward the innocent civilians of Palestine. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, the International Court of Justice has been the stage for more than 50 countries and a number of international organizations to make their case about the Israeli occupation of Palestine. In 2022, the United Nations General Assembly requested the ICJ to give a non-binding opinion of the legal consequences of the Israeli occupation. Monday was the final day of the hearings at The Hague. Will the ruling really make a difference? Well, we're going to look at this on The Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Jonathan Putab, international lawyer out of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And Kim Sharif, activist and lawyer out of London. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let me start it off in Lancaster and Jonathan. The ICJ is expected to take 6 months to issue its order. Let's start off here. Why? Why does it take 6 months?
Well, these are 15 judges who are jurists in their own right. By sitting on the World Court, they cannot write articles or books or for journals. So when there's a serious issue like this, they want to think about it thoroughly and write a detailed decision with the basis for the decision almost as important as the decision itself. So the ICJ always takes months and months, sometimes years, to reach an opinion. And if there are different opinions, if each justice wants to write their own twist on the conclusion, it does take time, yes.
Okay, well, Kim, I mean, is it difficult to determine if the Zionist regime's occupation is illegal or not?
Yes, good evening to you, Ms. Marcia, and your guest who has helpfully explained the situation. No, I mean, anyone watching the case, you don't have to be a lawyer to understand that this is an open and shut case. I mean, I would refer people to the presentations of the lawyer for the Arab League, who was a formidable guy who really clarifies everything legally from the beginning to now. And that shows you that this is an open and shut case, doesn't need that much time, especially in light of the current urgency that is taking place in Gaza itself, where at least 500 people are being killed a day, and mostly women and children. And that is really disgusting. It's extermination of people. We said years ago, never again. Never again must surely mean in relation to all humans, not just some humans and not others. And so I don't understand. I mean, I can accept that they need the time. I can accept that they are required by law and morally required to give reasoning for their judgment. And I expect them to be reviewing the written submissions of all the countries and organizations again to make sure that whatever reasoning they give is based on evidence and legal arguments presented to them rather than their own personal opinions. So, yes, to that extent, I can see why they need 6 months. But from an ordinary layperson's perspective, this shouldn't take a long time. It's an open and shut case. You don't have to be a lawyer to see that there is an immediate urgency that requires immediate decision rather than prolonged taking time. At least make an interim order. At least make an interim order. But in relation to the opinion, I expect it to take as long as they had stated because of the reasons I have just explained and our colleague over there, Jonathan, explained to you as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, Jonathan, there are some experts who believe that these moves by the ICJ is an attempt by the court to exert more sovereignty and move away from American hegemony. How do you see it?
Well, in a way, this case, together with the other case before the ICJ, is a challenge to international law itself, to the system of laws that has been created, mostly at the end of World War II, which has been failing the majority of the population of this planet. Initially, international law was created largely by European and American and Western countries to regulate the world in a certain way. Now, people in the South, people in the third world, developing countries, that are saying, okay, if international law is to be followed, it needs to address our needs, not just the needs of the powerful. And occupation is one of these issues. Occupation was to be a temporary state of affairs, where some people, wherever there's a war and some population falls under the occupation of the army of another country, it's supposed to be a temporary state of affair until peace comes and you restore the situation to the way it used to be before. Now, this occupation has been taking place for more than 50 years. And not only that, but Israel has not been following the Geneva Conventions and the Hague Conventions relating to protection of civilians under occupation. So some scholars started saying, well, this is no longer a belligerent occupation. This is actually itself an illegal occupation. This is not just a temporary thing that happened at the end of war. It's now becoming a permanent feature with no end in sight that looks more like annexation, that looks more like control and rule rather than a temporary belligerent occupation. That is why the case was brought. Please explain to us, what is this strange status? Is the occupation itself, has it become illegal because it's been for so long and because of the practices of Israel during the occupation, has rendered this no longer a belligerent occupation and a temporary state of affairs, but an actual de facto annexation.
Well, Kim, there are other experts who point out that the whole liberal system of which these international organizations are part of were created to protect U.S. hegemony, and that's what they continue to do. Your thoughts on that side of things?
Well, indeed, it is very hard to rebut that suggestion in light of what we have seen going on over the years since the creation of the UN to date. We haven't seen the Security Council, for example, being used as a platform for promotion of peace. We've seen it being used as a platform for warmongering, and lots of wars have taken place, illegal wars, albeit lots of them, and lots of genocides have been committed, and the Security Council has been dominated by what I term the bully boys, as I previously said, and you know who they are. And it is difficult to rebut the suggestion that this is about enabling the U.S. Regime to act as like an empire to the world, and therefore the rest of the world is just mere colonies of the U.S. empire. That can't surely be right, because, you see, the Security Council itself is on par, is an organ of the U.N. institution as a whole, on par with the court, on par with the Human Rights Council. Therefore, it can't see itself as above all on the basis of the ownership of nuclear weapons by certain states. You see, because if we say that we accept that argument, then we're saying that we live in the jungle, and this is the rule of the jungle, might is right, and the rest of the world is just mere colonies of this mighty regime that needs to be followed. And that can't be right, because this regime is actually, the U.S. regime, is a rogue regime, quite frankly, because it does not comply with any rule of law. It seems to regard itself above all and above everything, and humans and everything, and aiding and abetting genocide in Gaza and elsewhere, illegal wars in Iraq and elsewhere. We can't accept this situation to continue, because the world contains more than one country. There are 193 countries, member states of the UN itself. And all these countries are now waking up to the reality that they are being treated as mere colonial slaves. Some countries are still paying colonial taxes, apparently, and that's completely shocking to the core. And there is an awakening taking place in the world, and I feel that through the proceedings of the ICJ, as we have been watching up to today, as well as the upcoming case of the South African state that is against genocide. Now, under that case, once the court ruled that there is a prima facie case to answer against the charge of genocide, it is incumbent upon every country in the world. In fact, they are under a duty to act, and very quickly, to prevent and stop this genocide. But where are they? So, yes, the suggestion that this whole system has been kind of set up to empower and enable the rogue regime to take control of the world. It's difficult to rebut, seeing what has been happening over the years, for the past 70 years, throughout the time that the UN has been in existence. And one more point, which is quite shocking to know, perhaps for some people, is this: that when the Statute of Rome came into existence and the court in Hague was established for enforcement of the principles of and rules of the Treaty of Rome, apparently the U.S. has passed a law that enables it, that demands or enables it to invade Holland in case anybody from the U.S. is ever brought to justice there for war crimes and crimes against humanity or genocide. So it is considering or treating itself above the law, above humanity, above everything. That can't surely be right. We're all equal. We're all humans. Look at the Charter. As the Charter speaks about equality, the Charter speaks about inalienable right to self-determination for peoples. Why is this being denied to everybody? That's just ridiculous. Can't be sustained. This position cannot be sustained. It's not tenable. That's what I'm saying.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Right. Well, that was interesting, your point you made just now, Kim. And what about that, Jonathan? Because, yes, if we read so many of the charters, whether we're talking about the International Court of Justice or you're talking about the United Nations and so many of the other agencies that come under the United Nations, beautifully worded, talking about equality. But the reality is that we really have never seen that since 1945, when most of these were established after World War II. So at this point in time, do you think that the ruling of the ICJ is really going to make a difference? Can it make a difference? Because at the end of the day, it's also non-binding.
Yes, I think it can make a big difference. The question is, how do other people react to it? If you remember, one of the first non-binding advisory opinion was in the case of Namibia, where the occupation of Namibia by South Africa, they couldn't stop that occupation. They tried to go through the Security Council, and of course the veto by England and the United States prevented it. So the General Assembly asked the ICJ for an advisory opinion. And that advisory opinion was that the occupation was illegal and that it is the duty of all states to bring an end to that illegal occupation. As a result, there was an international movement to boycott South Africa, and corporations stopped dealing with South Africa. Sports events stopped allowing South African teams to play. And there was an international pressure that in the end led to the independence of Namibia and later to the end of the apartheid regime in South Africa itself. So the question is not just what is the opinion of the ICJ, but what is the reaction of the governments and the people of the world to that opinion. I'd like to explain, even regular courts, national courts, don't have at their disposal enforcement mechanisms. The enforcement is largely voluntary. It has moral authority, and everybody is supposed to follow it. And anybody who refuses to follow the decisions of the court becomes something of an outlaw or a person who tries to be outside of what the society and the community wants. So in a real way, the decision of the ICJ is as powerful as is the political will of governments and people to abide by it.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting point. Let me just start right there with Kim. So just according to what Jonathan is saying then, so it is as important as the governments that will abide by it. But we have seen over the years, and even now we're watching what is happening with the United States and the UK and some of the other other Western countries that are also hand in hand in this genocide. So we have seen that time and time again, those who wanted to stand up against these entities were sanctioned, punished, something had happened to them. So in general, do you think that we're at the point, because of this unbelievable genocide and what is taking place, that the countries of the world, Kim, are really willing to stand up against the United States, against the Western hegemony, against the Israeli regime, and the consequences that come with that?
I believe That is the case. I can feel it. I can see there is a movement of saying enough is enough. I mean, I have listened to the presentations made by the Colombian state, which is amazing, Namibian state, and many other states, and even Turkey. And it's amazing to see that that in the first place that these countries got together and made this application to explore and debate this this issue as to the occupation, whether it is legal or not. And it turns out that it's actually not legal. The occupation from the beginning, from the Balfour Declaration, is illegal, ab initio illegal. And therefore, every action taken thereafter is also illegal. And so there's so many crimes have been committed. So to see these countries, and of course, Indonesian state also made a very compelling representation. And to see all these countries getting together and the sanctions not working in as much as it used to many years ago. And also there are alternative economic scenes in the world platform today that are showing themselves to be credible forces to reckon with. I'm talking about BRICS. I'm talking about many other amazing movements taking place, the African Union. And many countries are waking up to the reality that they cannot allow the status quo to continue as it is, because it means effectively they are all being enslaved by one set of triad. I call them the dark triad, the dark triad enslaving the rest of the world, because it's, what they're doing is purely colonialism, and the rest of the world is beginning to wake up to this and say enough is enough. I feel that there is a change taking place, because you see, in some places you're not even allowed to say from the river to the sea, which is a statement which is contained in the constitution of the Likud party itself. But if you say it as a non-Israeli person, you will be accused of being anti-Semite, even if you're an Arab like me. I'm a Semite myself. So you'll be accused of being anti-Semite. But having said that, to see that all these countries getting together, making this application, to see South Africa being moved by what's going on, making the application it made, I think we can start to feel that there is a movement of change taking place. And what we need to do is support that movement of change and perhaps even encourage our own countries to see the common sense of supporting such a movement of treating human beings as equal, rather than holding a racist, colonialist mindset in relation to this to the rest of the world. That can't continue. That can't be right. It's actually a stigma, an anathema on our reputation as a country ourselves here in the UK, with the history of slavery, with colonialism. You know, the cases of the Mau Mau is still coming up. You know, people being raped with a broken beer bottles and that kind of thing. The shame is still there. Let's not continue building more shame on us. That's what I'm trying to say. And okay. I feel that there is a movement in the world that is awakening, is that saying enough is enough.
Okay, Jonathan, do you agree with Kim? And in general, do you think that these hearings are indicative of a change globally and how countries are starting to see the Israeli regime?
Yes, I think it is true. And a large part of it is because the Israelis are not hiding what they're doing. The Holocaust that took place in Germany took place in the dark. People didn't even know until after the war about the horrors of what the Nazis were doing to the Jews. Here, it is open. You see it on the social media. You see it on television screens. There's only one place where you don't see it very well, and that's in Israel, where they don't show that on their screens. And in the United States, of course, the media is also biased. But this is a reality that people are seeing, and that the Israelis are not hiding themselves. They're open about what they are doing. And this is going to lead to a lot of changes in the world. You must understand that international law itself developed to a large degree as a result of ordinary people being fed up with the horrors of World War II and feeling the need to do something to create a new order where it's not just the powerful can do whatever they want. And in a real way, it has worked. For most world, the idea of taking over somebody else's country next to you because you had historic rights over it, or because you have a security interest.
Well, Jonathan, I'm sorry to interrupt you here. Has it worked? I mean, you say in reality, okay, this came about after World War II because of a need for something better. Has it worked or has it been unfair from the very beginning? We see which countries were, for example, with the International Court of Justice, which countries have been accused, which countries have not, which countries have actually committed unbelievable crimes since World War II, but no one dared to either try them or no one actually paid the price for their crimes. So has it worked or was it based on inequality from the very beginning?
It hasn't worked in all cases. It hasn't worked all the time, but it has largely worked. Let me explain why.
Okay.
If you look at the larger historical picture, between 1948 and today, there have only been about four or five cases where a country tried to expand its borders and annex nearby countries. One of them was Iraq and Kuwait. Another was Western Sahara. Another was the Ukraine. And another is Israel, annexing the Golan Heights and annexing East Jerusalem and trying to annex. But that's, very few out of the 194 countries, many of which have disputes with their neighbors. And they find different ways of dealing with it rather than just capturing their neighbor's country or portions of it to fulfill. So I agree with you. It hasn't always worked. And certainly the veto power at the Security Council has prevented the implementation in an objective way across the board. But this is where the population, if the governments don't work, the ordinary population can influence things through things like BDS.
Okay, Jonathan, I'm just about out of time, but Kim, final thoughts. Go ahead, please.
We do run into enforcement, and there is a need for an international campaign to enforce the rule of law. And that means that the campaign must be increased in intensity, persuading these countries that made the application at the ICJ for the opinion to also apply immediate sanctions against the criminal regime. As the Yemeni state has done in Sana'a, the parliament has passed sanctions against rogue regimes and its personnel. And also it's enforcing the rules by imposing economic sanctions on Israeli-bound ships. By the way, there are thousands of ships passing unhindered. Only Israeli, UK and US are being obstructed simply because they are aiding and abetting and committing genocide. And that's a very serious crime. And the state of Yemen takes that very seriously and in compliance. Well, by the way, Yemen was one of the very first members of the UN when it was established.
I'm sorry, but
the rule of law.
We are out of time. I thank you both for being with us. Jonathan Kotab, international lawyer. Out of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, Kim Sharif, activist and lawyer out of London. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. Goodbye.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In the United States, Congress is racing towards 1st of March and 8th of March deadlines to fund the federal government. And military families are bracing for another possible U.S. government shutdown. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Bessa Pinchotti was juggling tasks in her car, returning calls on her cell phone in between dentist visits for her children, when, after pausing for a moment, she said into her phone, "Military families are sick of feeling like political pawns." She waited a beat and then emphasized the word sick. Pinchotti, the wife of a U.S. Marine Corps veteran, operates an email list of hundreds of thousands of military families from her post with the National Military Family Association based in Virginia. For the third time in less than 6 months, Pinchotti has warned U.S. military families about the potentially blistering impact of a government shutdown. Congress is racing towards 1st of March and 8th of March deadlines to fund the federal government. If no deal is agreed upon this week, a series of key programs and services for U.S. military service members and their families will shut down. If a deal isn't reached by 8th of March, the Pentagon itself is at risk of disruption. Short-term continuing resolutions were agreed upon by Congress just hours before the prior two deadlines for federal government shutdowns, creating a disruptive rhythm for federal workers and service members who worry their paychecks and services will be interrupted. The brinkmanship has now returned again. With continuing resolution after continuing resolution after continuing resolution, our families keep feeling the uncertainty, Pinchotti said. The first of the two deadlines, which arrives on Friday, 1st of March, endangers the federal government's WIC program, which provides food and nutritional assistance for women and children. The National Military Family Association estimates that more than 200,000 military families rely upon WIC services. A government shutdown also risks disruption in April to the SNAP program, which helps provide food for other low-income families, including those with connections to the U.S. military. Half of junior enlisted spouses say they have experienced food insecurity. Cuts or delays for food assistance programs would be devastating. It's deeply unfair to our service members that Republicans are bringing us to the brink of another government shutdown and are putting politics ahead of our national security and those protecting it, said Democratic Representative Ro Khanna of California. Military paychecks are also at risk of delay or disruption by late March. The brave Marines who serve at Marine Corps Base Quantico in my district and the tens of thousands of service members and military families that I represent should not be left wondering about the status of their next paycheck or if they will be able to access the benefits that help these families make ends meet, according to Representative Abigail Spanberger, a Democrat who represents a heavy concentration of military communities in Northern Virginia. Members of Congress have also warned about potential disruptions on military posts and bases. In a November report ahead of a prior government funding deadline, the Washington, D.C.-based Partnership for Public Service warned post and base services would also be curtailed or closed, elective medical procedures would be postponed, eroding morale, and critical training activities would be delayed, leading to postponed promotions. The American Legion has issued warnings about potential disruptions to its members as well. In a statement issued ahead of a prior government shutdown deadline in October, the organization emphasized the potential risk to military recruitment. Hundreds of thousands of civilians in the Department of Defense, the DOD, would be furloughed, affecting how the department manages its affairs globally, the American Legion said in its statement. That includes recruiting new members, which has already been problematic for the service branches. Congressman Rob Whitman, the Republican vice chair of the House Committee on Armed Services, said this uncertainty is another reason why Congress must return to passing government funding bills by regular order. We cannot keep putting our military members and their families at risk of missing a paycheck or losing access to critical programs. Congress is lurching and limping from deadline to deadline as it struggles to navigate divided control and historically small majorities. Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson and his predecessor, Kevin McCarthy, have needed overwhelming support from Democrats to muster short-term spending deals. Republicans' majority in the House has shrunk even further after Democrats won the special election in New York's 3rd congressional district earlier this month, filling former Representative George Santos's seat. Both political parties have accused the other of prolonging or exacerbating the gridlock that continues to prevent the passage of longer-term spending deals that provide more certainty to U.S. military families. Congress has also failed to come up with a consensus on large-scale legislation or initiatives to help improve the overall quality of life for U.S. service members. The fact that these families have to rely on programs like WIC is a reality that needs to be addressed immediately, with pay increases for our service members, said Representative Jen Kiggins, a Republican who represents a large U.S. Navy community near Newport News in Virginia. Jen Kiggins also introduced legislation last September that ensured service members are paid in the event of a government shutdown. Pinchotti said the latest round of brinkmanship comes at a particularly sensitive moment for her family and others who have relatives in the U.S. military. It's time to choose summer camps and plan vacations and prepare for moves for the next school year, said Pinchotti, and there's so much uncertainty. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story and tells us more. Leaders in both political parties are racing to secure a deal on government spending as the negotiation window quickly closes and fears of a shutdown grow more pronounced. Congress returns to Washington next week facing a pair of looming funding deadlines, on 1st of March for a handful of agencies and on 8th of March for the rest, leaving lawmakers with little time to iron out their differences and get bills to the floor of the House to keep the government open. While Speaker of the House Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, has moved deftly to avoid a shutdown since taking the gavel last October, restive conservatives are losing patience with his willingness to cut budget deals across the aisle. And some observers on Capitol Hill are already warning that the current fight is the greatest shutdown threat of this Congress. I'm worried of all the scares we've had since the last fiscal year. I think this is going to be the scariest. I think we could be in a world of hurt, according to a Senate GOP aide. I don't know if it will be a partial or a full government shutdown, but I think the chances of a shutdown are the highest we've had this fiscal year. Party leaders in both chambers have sought to assure the public and the markets that the sides will come together to adopt the appropriation bills and avoid any disruptions to government operations. But a number of disagreements remain between the two political parties, and House Speaker Mike Johnson is facing additional pressures from his own Republican conference, where conservatives are demanding right-wing policy riders that are a non-starter with Democrats in both Congress and the White House. The mix of factors, political, tactical, and temporal, is sparking plenty of concerns that Congress will be unable to reach an agreement to prevent a partial government shutdown that is looming at the end of next week. I think the odds are 50-50 at this point, said Representative Patrick McHenry, Republican of North Carolina. McHenry, chair of the Financial Services Committee, called the current shutdown threat a preventable disaster, one that might have been avoided if party leaders had moved the spending bills late last year instead of kicking the process into an election year. McHenry urged House Speaker Mike Johnson to resist the ultimatums from his conservative wing of the Republican Party and move forward with whatever agreements emerge from the talks between appropriators, who have been working furiously throughout the holiday recess to finalise their bills in time for the first deadline, which is on Friday, 1st of March.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio.